The BBC presents My Word. And here to introduce the programme and the panel is Jack Longland.
My Word is a word game played by people whose business is words, and those taking part are Dillis Power, Anne Scott James, Frank Muir, and Dennis Norton. Here's round one. Try and test their vocabulary. Two marks if they get the meanings right. Beginning with Anne Scott James. Anne, what is a jabot? J-A-B-O-T.
A jabot? Oh, it's a frilly piece of neckwear. It's now usually part of a woman's blouse, but I think it was originally a part of an 18th century gentleman's costume.
And it might be a 20th century gentleman's costume. Isn't
yes, the, now the frilly shirts come.
If you have frilly shirt for a man, that could be a jabot too, I think.
I disapprove, though.
Well, it wouldn't alter the meaning of the
word. No.
Two marks. Frank, the meaning of the word hebdomadal. H-E-B-D-O-M-A-D-A-L. Hebdomadal.
Hebdomadal. Hebdomadal. Oh, yes, this is quite clear. It's what a doctor with adenoids calls the stomach. You are very sensitive about the hebdomadal area.
Nice, but not true.
Every seventh.
What?
It's every seventh something.
Yes.
Every seventh day. It's once a week.
It means something that happens weekly. Once a week it is. Too much. Phyllis Powell, what is a stopple?
Stopple?
S-T-O-P-P-L-E, a stopple.
Stopple is a stopper.
Yeah.
It is a stopper.
Yes. Stopper for what?
A bottle.
The whole thing sounds a little drunken, but it's a real word, and it is exactly that. It's a stopper for a bottle. And it can be, you can't stopple it. I mean, you can use it as a verb, too. That is, put the stopper in the bottle. That's stoppling. Two marks. Dennis Norden, what is a dragee? D-R-A-G-E-E. I'm sorry about the French accent, but I think this is necessary. A dragee.
Oh, yeah. I never called it a dragee. It's a dragee. and there's no such thing as a dragee. It's like saying a salted peanut.
Yes.
It doesn't exist in the singular at all. They're those little chocolate things that you always have at least eight of.
Yes.
So there isn't such a thing as a dragee.
I think that's jolly good, Dennis. Well, dragees are these chocolate drops or sweetmeats. So you can cheat the unfortunate child by putting a powder or drug inside it, which is very unfair. Two marks. Well, before we begin round two, I give each team a quotation for them to write down, and then I want the two women members of the team to keep on studying their quotations, and at the end of the program, I shall ask them where they come from. So, Anne Scott James and Dennis Norden, here's your quotation. A bird in a gilded cage, and Phyllis Powell and Frank Muir, yours is, you always hurt the one you love. And then at the end of the program, I shall ask Dennis and Frank to give me their ideas as to how these words came to be said or written. Well, round two is a quick quiz round. Two marks, if you get them right, and it's all to do with Shakespeare. Anne Scott James, the subtitle of Shakespeare's Othello.
The Moor of Venice.
The Moor of Venice it is. Frank Muir, the subtitle of Hamlet.
Oh, Little by Little.
Much more accurate.
Hamlet, comma, Prince of Denmark.
Hamlet, comma, Prince of Denmark it is. Well done, two marks. Dillis Powell, subtitle of Shakespeare's Cymbeline.
Not As You Like It.
No.
I didn't do Cymbeline, did you?
No,
Seems
never.
To have done
no.
us.
Yes, we have.
What was he, Dillis?
What was he? I don't know.
Prince of Tyre.
It's really quite simple. He was King of Britain. He was Cunobelinus. He was a legendary King of Britain.
Right.
Dennis Norden, you've been helped a bit. The subtitle of Pericles.
Prince of Tyre.
There it is. I can't help giving you two marks. Next round is origins and derivations of words or phrases. In other words, the present meaning and how it came to have that meaning, what the original meaning was. Marked up to a possible maximum of three marks. Beginning with Anne Scott James, and the verb to
ostracize.
Oh, to ostracize means to exile somebody. And it comes from the casting of the votes into the ostracon or pot. Oh, an ostracon was a pot, was a pot's herd in ancient Athens. They cast their ostracons into the pot, and if enough went in, the poor man was exiled.
And nowadays, if you used it today, what did it mean?
Oh, it just means to send to Coventry, really. It's more likely.
Well done, 3 marks. Ostracised, meaning nowadays to cut someone or banish them or send them to Coventry, cut them out of one circle. And it does go back to this word ostracon, which meant originally in Oystershire, but it meant a word which none of us ever use these days, a potsherd, which was a little piece out of a pot, a broken bit. And you scribbled the chap's name, if you wanted him, sent out away from the city and banished, and he was normally banished for 5 or 10 years.
Aristides was the one, the man ostracised. He was tired of hearing him called the good, wasn't
the
he?
Just.
The just.
He was so good, they had to get rid of him. Frank Muir, pidgin English.
Oh, pidgin English is a kind of approximate English, which is the best that some parts of the Far East can manage in the way of speaking English, because their throats and lips are used to forming different sounds from the Western vowels and consonants.
Yes. And
that's a very boring answer, isn't it?
No, jolly good. How did it come to be called pidgin English, then?
Well, if you hear a pidgin talking English, it's, all it can manage is coo and caw. And they therefore came to be adopted, spelled differently.
Frank is quite right about what it is. That is, it's a simple, broken English form of speaking. A butcher is a man belong bull and a cow, and a hungry becomes belly belong me walk about, and so on and so on. But the pidgin was the nearest, in fact, that the Chinese could get to the rather odd English word business. What they said when they tried to say business was pidgin. So pidgin English meant business English.
Oh, come.
No, this is the way in which you transacted your whatever it was, buying and selling, between English merchants and the Chinese. And so this curious form of English grew up. But pidgin and business, if you look at your dictionary, are meant to be the same. Now, dear Liz Proud, to take something with a pinch of salt or with a grain of salt.
Well, it means not entirely to believe it.
Yes. And originally?
Originally, Frank.
It's Latin.
Yes.
Cum guano salis.
Yes.
Yes, that's good.
Well, it was a form of currency, wasn't it, salt?
Yes.
It means it needs some additional something or other.
Yes.
In other words, it can't be believed until something's been added.
My learned colleague is really...
He's doing very well.
Doing
I think
well.
2.5 this time. Mm. It means to view a statement with a considerable amount of doubt or scepticism. In other words, you believe part of it, not the rest. It comes from the Latin, as they rightly said, cum grano salis. And it originally, because salt appeared to be rather hard to get at or something, or was a bit expensive, food tended to be very lightly salted or not salted at all, so that the guests could add their own salt to suit their own particular tastes. So a statement has very little truth in it, just as you would anticipate very little salt in the dish as originally served to you. 2.5 out of 3. Dennis Norden, The Spoils of War.
Well, the spoils of war are what you get if you win a war.
Yes.
Such as export problems, flight from the pound, and things like that.
Oh, it's the booty, isn't it? You
blue booties for a boy. it must be the Latin for booty or something.
Yes, it was something else. It did come to mean booty perfectly well. So I think
well,
again,
truth is booty, and that is all I know.
2 out of 3, I think, is fair. It's the plunder and booty that goes to the victor. Spolium was originally the hide stripped from an animal which you'd killed in hunting, and this is the bit you got. So spoiling meant originally removing the hide. Gradually, meaning was expanded to mean any kind of booty after a fight. 2 marks, I think. Well, the next round is the who, why, and what department. 2 marks, if you can give me the answers to the following. Anne Scott James, who, according to what poet, in what poem, sings each song twice over?
Oh, this is Browning.
Yes.
It's Ode to Be in England is the poem. It must be the Blackbird,
no.
Isn't it? Quick, help.
That's the wise thrush. He sings his song twice over, lest you think he never should recapture that first part.
All right, thrush, Browning, oh, to be in England.
Well done.
Home thoughts from abroad.
You've got the whole thing right. I think I was supposed to be only giving two this time. 2.5, I think, because you did extremely well. Robert Browning, Home Thoughts from Abroad, and they got the first lines right, too. 2.5. Frank Muir. Demurest of the tabby kind, the pensive Selima reclined.
What do you want to know?
I want to know what happened to Selima. Or Selima.
Selima was drowned in a tub of goldfish. And it was the pet of Horace Walpole. Horace Walpole was very unlucky with pets. His Charles II Spaniel was eaten by wolves when he was crossing the Alps in a diligence. Thomas Gray, who was a great friend of Walpole's, and they travelled abroad on the Grand Tour in his youth, wrote a poem in 1741 about this this cat that died falling into a tub of goldfish. There wasn't any more.
No, I think that's absolutely smashing. I'm astonished.
The interesting thing about Thomas Gray was he had a very small output, about four odes, four Pindaric odes, some Celtic pieces, a piece of Irish, the elegy in a country churchyard, and most of them ended in quotations, including this one, which ends in, "Nor all that glisters gold."
Well, that seems a magnificent bit of erudition by Frank.
You also should have been poet laureate after on the death of Collie Cibber, but he refused.
Well, definitely 3 marks out of 2.
He was wanted to stay.
He wanted to stay with the lads.
Soldiers.
I'm speechless.
He never married.
Yes, I'm.
All right, back to Dennis Boyle. What are referred to in what poem by which poet in the following lines? They stretched in never-ending line along the margin of a bay, 10,000 saw I at a glance, tossing their heads in sprightly dance.
Daffodils.
By
William Wordsworth.
Well done. 2 marks straight away. Dennis Norden. What was referred to by which writer when he wrote the words, "Thou art not so unkind as man's ingratitude"?
Oh, this was the celebrated blow, the winter wind. "Thou art not so unkind as man's ingratitude."
Yes.
And something about it, "although thy breath be rude."
That's it. Yes, quite right. And do you remember which play it comes in?
Comes in As You Like It.
Yes.
And it's said by that fellow with a name I can never remember. It's Hardy Amis or...
Amiens.
Amiens, bless
you. One of the courtiers who was in exile in the forest with the Duke. "Blow, blow, thy winter wine, thou art not so unkind as man's ingratitude. Thy tooth is not so keen because thou art not seen, although thy breath be rude." Act 2, I think, of As You Like It. 2 marks again. Well, on the next round, it's about abbreviations which were used during the Second World War. What did the following stand for? Anne Scott James, LDV.
Oh, it was the force which preceded the Home Guard,
yes,
wasn't it? Something or other. Local Defence Volunteers.
Well done. Local Defence Volunteers, a rather clumsy title, which afterwards is turned into Home Guard. 2 marks. Frank Muir, FFI.
Free from infection.
I'm bound to give you that. There is another, rather more official one.
The French forces.
Yes.
Of the interior.
That's it. Well done. FFI is the French forces of the interior. That is the French who fought behind the lines when France was occupied by Germany. But it is also an army phrase for free from infection. So you get it on both counts. 2 marks. Dillis Fowle, OSS.
Office of Secret...
Special Services.
Not quite.
Secret... it's the American...
Yes, American.
American sort of intelligence.
They think globally.
Office of...
Spherical Services.
Special?
Special Spheres. Office of Special...
I think one out of two. It's the Office of Strategic Services, which was the United States organization for gathering strategic information and for carrying out special missions in enemy territory. Dennis Norden, this looks more difficult. I know that it is. Cossack. C-O-S-S-A-C.
It is.
It's longer.
It's longer.
It's longer, yes.
Only the military mind could think that's short for anything.
C-O-S-S-A-C.
I know what the A-C is. It's the... and that's the other bit.
Yes?
Commanding officer, special squadron ablutions cleaners.
I think this chef had
that
rather...
That was my outfit, Jack.
I think this chef had rather more exalted rank than that, Dennis.
Was he chief of?
Yes, chief of.
Chief it starts of like S.
A, or chief of... There's
chief
a
of staff.
Yes, that's it.
South Africa, South Asian Command.
1.5 out of 2. That's a pretty good shot. Chief of Staff to the Supreme Allied Commander.
Oh.
And this was used as a code word later on for Allied headquarters in London.
That's right.
And now we come to the last round and go back to those two quotations I gave the teams earlier on in the programme. And first, for 2 marks, and Scott James, can you give me the origin of your quotation, a bird in a gilded cage?
She was only a bird in a gilded cage. And it's a musical song, I think.
Yes. Do you remember any other lines?
A pitiful sight to see.
Yes.
She was only a bird in a gilded cage, a pitiful sight to see.
As though it seems he was happy and free from care, which is not what she seems to be.
That's right.
I think of her wasted life. It's sad when you think of her wasted life, for you cannot mate with age. Her beauty was sold. Her beauty was sold for an old man's gold. She's a bird in a gilded cage.
Well, you can't beat that.
And then I wrote, yep.
It was in the year 1900, the beginning of the century, and it was by
Arthur...
Well,
it was certainly not the Beatles, yeah.
Arthur Lamb.
It was one
of the music by a chap called Harry von Tiltzer, I think.
Harry von Tiltzer, yes.
And he was the musician, and Arthur Lamb wrote the libretto. Well done, 2 marks. Now, Dillis Powell, the origin of your quotation, which was, you always hurt the one you love.
That must be a song.
Mm-hmm.
You were a popular
song.
Yes.
A recent song. Fairly recent.
Yes, it is. Yeah.
The Ink Spots.
That's all right. I think it's by Doris Fisher and Alan Roberts, but it was sung by the Ink Spots, to name but a few. Well, I'm now going to ask Frank and Dennis to give me their explanation of how these quotations came into being. And on this occasion, the marks will go to whichever unlikely explanation receives the longer amount of applause from the audience here in the theatre. So, back to Dennis Norden, and if you remember, his quotation was, a bird in a gilded cage.
Frank and I, and indeed every scriptwriter in this country, are members of a sort of trade union called the Writers' Guild, which is not quite as powerful as the Mafia yet. But we do have our own offices in a basement in Harley Street. Everybody who comes down into these offices is struck by the decor, which is a particularly revolting shade of light brown. And they say, surely you can do better than that. And we say we could, but we keep it this colour as a memento of our early days. You see, because there wasn't always a Writers' Guild. At one time, writers were separate individuals in the early days of radio and television, and we were very badly treated by everybody. You would write an hour play for radio, and they would pay you 4 and 11. And you also had to mow the producer's hedge, take off his riding boots and man the BBC lift during lunch hour. That's what they did to you before we had a guild. Then along came a man, a writer called Ted Willis, and he said, rise and throw off the yoke that the oppressors have upon your neck. Now perhaps we'll get 7 and 6 for an hour's play, which we do now. And he said, the first thing to do is if we make them respect us, we've got to have offices and headed notepaper and a typewriter and a switchboard and a secretary called Lil. And we obtained all these things in these abandoned premises at Harley Street, 21 steps down. 12 physically, 9 socially, actually. And the first problem was to decorate it. We didn't have any money, so we had to decorate it ourselves, and we all had to throw in contributions towards decorating. Well, now, in those days, some of us used to get paid in kind for our work, for our writing. For example, there was a writer, an unknown writer called Edward J. Mason, who used to write a daily radio serial called The Archers and Everyday Story of Country Folk, and he got paid in farm produce. When I say farm produce, it was fertilizer, actually. It was bone meal, very dark brown bone meal, which he raised a large family on. He used to make this wonderful stew, actually, with it, and he threw 4 sacks of this in towards decorating. And Frank and I, we were paid in kind. We were working for another unknown comedian called Jimmy Edwards. And he used to give us bottles of anything he didn't care to drink. So we had these 3,800 bottles of milk. So we threw in 28 bottles of milk. And that was what we used for decorating. The bottles of the sacks of dark brown bone meal and these bottles of milk, which were rather aged, actually, and curdled. And if you mix together, I don't know if you know this, dark brown bone meal and curdled milk, you do come up with this rather striking beige colour, which, as I say, revolts everybody who sees it. But we keep it that way because it reminds us of the fight that we have been through. And what we say is, let other unions be splendid in gilt or magnificent in purple, but we're a guild in a curdled beige.
Well, I can't bear to wait to get to the wrong end of Harley Street. And now we go on to Frank Muir, and if you remember, his quotation was, "You always hurt the one you love."
You always hurt the one you love. How terribly true that is. How terribly, terribly, terribly true. I've got an aunt I love, and I always hurt her because she lives in Australia, and I never seemed to get round to writing to her. And now it's a year since I've written to Aunt Rose in Australia. And I do love her for a very special reason, because she's my fan. Lots of people listen to this program in Australia, but Aunt Rose has heard every one of them. And she wrote to me, and she said, "I've listened to you very carefully, on my word, and almost all the time you use old jokes and things you've said before, but always in each program, there's a little laugh that we haven't heard before." And she's seen that, she's spotted it, and that's why I love Aunt Rose. But this terrible thing, when one sits down at home after a day's work, you know, the mind is willing, the flesh is willing, I hold the pen, and suddenly the hand atrophies, and I can't sort of start. So I thought tonight, with the producer's permission, I'd just write a sort of verbal letter to Aunt Rose. Annisthorpe, Egham, Surrey. Never mind the date. "Dearest Aunt Rose, well, it's been a terribly busy year and lots has happened. Last June, did I tell you when Polly got her zip stuck? She was climbing into a dress and asked me to help her, and it was tweed, and the zip got stuck, and I bent down to look at it, and I whisked the zip up, and it suddenly freed, and I got my moustache caught in her zip. We had to go to the doctor to free us. It was very embarrassing walking along the village street. But I got Sally to ride on my back and pretend it was a child's game. Lots of people followed behind us, quite a large crowd, and several interesting suggestions were made as to what we were doing. They said, it is a student's rag, a lady said, and a gentleman said, it is a protest. against too many westerns on television. The doctor cut it away, and I was a bit one-sided for a week, and then it grew again. Must close now. P.S. Dear Aunt Rose, thank you so much for listening to the programme, and I always think of you as my fan, because lots of people in Australia, I understand, have listened to this programme. But when you listened, you heard nearly every one. But also when you listened, you, Aunt Rose of all people, you, in the words of the song, you always heard the one new laugh.
Well, by your vote, Dennis Norden just wins the contest of the two stories, and it brings us to a final score in which he and Anne Scott James win by 1.5 marks from Dilys Bauer and Frank Muir. And that also brings to an end this edition of My Word.
In My Word, you heard Dilys Powell, Anne Scott James, Frank Muir and Dennis Norden, introduced by Jack Longland. The programme was devised by Tony Shryan and Edward J. Mason and presented by the BBC.